Welcome, everybody. This is the fourth and final lecture for the Mises Academy online class, Economics of Obamacare. And this is lecture four, which covers what I'm just titling Loose Ends and International. And as you're going to see, and you can see from the outline, actually, most of it's going to be what I'm calling Loose End, because I think that's more relevant. What I'm doing here is also touching on some stuff that I promised I would look into, but also answering a bunch of your guys' questions from previous lectures. So I may not have hit everything, and then of course I can't anticipate what you guys might throw at me in this particular lecture. So chances are, even by the time I'm done with this, there will still be some outstanding questions, in which case, you know, I'll go through and probably like send an email blast out. After I get the quiz for this week up, then I'll go through and see if I'm forgetting anything. But I think I hit most of the major topics you guys have been asking me about. I kept putting you off saying, well, I'm going to cover that, don't worry. So that's a lot of what we're doing tonight. And then the last main topic tonight will be looking at international comparisons. That's one of the trump cards, like I say, that progressives will pull out, is to say, you guys keep talking about how awful Obamacare is going to be, but look at other developed countries and, you know, GA countries, G20, whatever designation you want to include, has what you guys would call socialized medicine, and they're not all keeling over from heart attacks all the time. So clearly you guys are a bunch of paranoid nut jobs. So we'll look a little bit at that, and I'll show you some things in that category. Before we jump into the main lecture, let me make an announcement. I know that some of you have been having difficulties accessing some course material, and they tell me, if you have an Apple device, check the news form for a convenient new way to access course materials. Okay, so I think what that means is, if you have an iPhone or an iPad, that you can, now there's a way you can grab the stuff using those devices. Let me see if I'm being correct. Or an iPod Touch, Danny said. I knew I shouldn't have deviated from the script. All the tech guys are going, oh no, he's going off script. Okay. I still use a dial-up modem, and it's a rotary phone. And it's actually one of those crank phones. I gotta hold it and go, and then I say, hello, Bellevue 347, person-to-person call. Okay, so tonight we're doing, the first thing we're going to cover here is the employer mandate. So let me walk you guys through this, and you can get a sense, because before we've just been throwing that out, right? We've been focusing on the individual mandate. A lot of your questions concern this, and so I thought I should spend some time and just walk you through the details of this. Also, another thing, too, I should just say as a general caveat to all this, is I'm sure you know, if you've been following the news, a lot of this stuff, we don't know exactly what's going to be the relevant law, because if groups complain, for all we know, the White House is going to say, yeah, go ahead, and you know, you don't have to do that. And so, for example, with the outrage over people getting dropped from the insurance plans, you know, people who had, oh, you know what? Let me, I just realized I'm still on the Wi-Fi. I'm plugged into my computer. It's not, let me, oh boy. All right, I'm gonna take a chance and try to switch to the cable. Okay, can you guys still hear me at this point? Can somebody just confirm my coming? Okay, great. I think that will actually ensure a better connection going forward. Okay, so what they did is, I mean, this is just how ridiculous stuff is my understanding is the White House, the way they dealt with that was to just say, don't worry, we're not going to prosecute any of you insurance companies, at least in 2014, if you have what technically is a substandard plan. Right, so that was what they were floating I don't even know if that's still on the table. The thing is so fluid. But that was what the White House's official position was right when that big outcry kicked in, when all the people were freaking out because, hey, you told us you could keep our plan if we wanted it. I like my plan, and I'm getting kicked off. When all the notices were going out from the insurance companies. And so that's what the White House was doing. But then all the insurance – but it wasn't that they were saying we're going to change the law. I mean, they can't, right? As you know in civics class, or if you were a little kid and you used to watch that TV show about how a bill becomes a law, right? Congress makes the legislation and approves it, and the president can either sign it or veto it. But it's not like the president has the authority to just say, you know what, I'm going to change this aspect of this huge piece of legislation. They can't do that. And so effectively what they were doing was basically telling everybody, yeah, those plans are actually going to be illegal according to the law, but don't worry, wink, wink, you can trust us. We won't prosecute you. We'll give you more time to let people, get into better plans or to make the transition, because we realize this is kind of shocking people. We want to be nice guys about it. So of course, all the health insurance companies were, saying, well, wait a minute, we've been running the actuarial figures and so on, and we've been revising everything, and now you're telling us in November, oh, that's all out the window, and the plans that people are currently on actually are good, at least for another year. But strictly speaking, according to the letter of the law, they're going to be illegal, but trust us, we won't prosecute. So that's just how chaotic all this stuff was. And so what I'm doing here is I am going through what the official rules are, and the official understanding was, in some cases, it would have been as of early 2013. What we're going to see with this employer mandate, for example, is I'm walking through a particular legal firm's summary of this is what we're handing to our clients who own businesses to tell them this is our understanding of the ACA as it impacts employers and what you need to do. Okay, so that's the big caveat in all this stuff, is that for all we know, these rules have changed midstream. But in any event, so first of all, one thing is the definition of 50 plus employees, because remember, the employer mandate, hang on a second, let me get my pen going here. I forgot to turn that thing. All right, so the employer mandate itself only applies to firms that have 50 or more full-time employees. Okay, so then that raises the question, well, how do you actually count that, right? And that's, like I say, it's not just with the Obamacare stuff, but in general, with regulations on the energy sector, I'm familiar with that in particular because I do a lot of work on the energy sector. These humongous bureaucratic documents come out, and it's literally like 85 pages just to explain what they're going to do. The one I was looking at recently for something, the Department of Energy is issuing a proposal for regulating furnace fans, the energy efficiency of the fans inside of a furnace. And it's like the document I was looking at, something like 80 pages, but then that's just referring to some earlier thing that's a lot more than 80 pages. Okay, so part of it's just craziness and, oh, yeah, that's the government for you. But the other part is, if they're going to start cracking down and punishing people for breaking the law that Congress enacted or, passed and that the president signed, they have to get really specific. They don't want to just leave it up to judges and juries to determine, did this company break the law? They need some guidance. So that's why these regulatory bodies would have to issue huge documents, and then they open it up for comment periods, and the various interested parties, called stakeholders, then comment on the interpretation of the federal agency for the regarding the statutory power they have been given. Okay, so this stuff gets really complicated. So anyway, back to the issue at hand here. I'm just saying it sounds cut and dry when they say something like, oh, this just applies to firms with 50 or more full-time employees. So then that raises the question, well, hang on, you know, what if there were a firm that had 55 full-time employees and then they hired 55 more and made everybody work half-time? So they had 110 part-time employees that were doing the same jobs as, you know, can I do that? So that kind of stuff. So anyway, according to, so they had issued, it was actually 144 pages was the IRS document that walked through all this stuff. So I didn't go through the 144 pages. I relied on, I'll put the link in small print down here if you want to go look it up yourself. I looked around that it seemed like these, it's from a law firm and it seemed like they knew what they were talking about. So anyway, that's what I'm relying on for these bullet points. And this is consistent with the commentary I've seen elsewhere. So I have reason to believe that this is accurate. So anyway, the way they do it is, so just be careful, there's two different things. In this calculation, to determine whether the firm itself falls under the scope of Obamacare, the question is, do they have 50 or more full-time employees? And on that narrow question, part-time employees do count in what's called their full-time equivalent. Okay, so what they do is they'll look at the employees, and if for a given employee in a given month, if that person has worked on average more than or 30 or more hours per week, that person is a full-time employee for this calculation. Okay, but then they will also look at how many total hours other employees worked combined. And then they will divide that number by 120 and come up with the part or the full-time equivalent number of employees. Right. So the way it works out in practice is if you had two part-time workers and they each worked 15 hours a week for every week of the month, when all was said and done, they would count as the equivalent of one full-time worker. You see how that works? All right. So the point is the part-time workers do sort of add as fractional amounts of a full-time worker to determine how big is this company. Is this a company that's big enough that it's going to fall under the scope of the legislation? Okay, but now the other issue, though, is once a firm is big enough, if it has 50 or more full-time employees, so yet this thing now falls under the scope of the legislation, the mandate does not apply to all the workers. It only applies to the full-time workers in that firm. And for that calculation, the part-time stuff doesn't matter, right? So if you have two part-time workers, so you got a firm that's big enough that using the previous calculation, it's 50 or more employees, okay? So this firm's now on the hook, and the employer has to provide health care for all full-time workers. But if he has two part-time workers each working 15 hours a week, it's not like he has to give half of a health care policy to each worker. You see what I'm saying? So no, you're only on the hook as an employer for the actual human beings who are full-time workers. It's not that you add all the part-time workers up together and that's some sort of additional liability. The part-time workers do enter into the calculation fractionally, but only to gauge the size of the firm to see, is this a big enough firm that we're even gonna get this thing in our crosshairs? Of course, that's not the language they use. Okay, another little thing you just gotta watch out for when you're looking at some of these statistical comparisons is that under the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, to make sure no one's losing, if I'm saying ACA, that's the more formal title for what we're all calling Obamacare. The way they're defining a full-time worker is 30 hours or more per week. That's actually a broader classification. The Bureau of Labor Statistics, typically when they crunch their numbers and they report various data in terms of part-time versus full-time employment, their criterion is 35 or more hours per week. All right, so just keep that in mind. So with some of this stuff, how can I put it? In case I forget to come back to this later, when we're looking at the aggregate statistics, it's possible we wouldn't see it. I'm trying to think, is that how that works? Yeah, well, in any event, I'm getting mixed up as to which way we cut. But in any event, you want to be careful of this, because later on I'm going to show you, even though we have lots of anecdotal evidence of major employers who are strictly limiting their staff to working 29 or fewer hours, thus far in the data, it's not jumping out that this was a big effect. And so I'm saying one thing you just got to watch out for is the data we're relying on classifies the distinction between part-time and full-time as 35 or more hours. So obviously, that would mute the effect, because what's going on is if there were a lot of people before who were getting 30, 31, 32, 33, or 34 hours a week, and now they're all being limited to 29, they're obviously being hurt by this. They're getting fewer hours. But in the statistics, the way the BLS records them, before they would have been part-time, and now they're still part-time. So you wouldn't see a spike in part-time employees, even though in reality there would have been people getting their hours cut. All right. But if you had somebody who before was working 40 hours and now is getting cut down to 29, that's going to show up in the aggregate statistics. Okay. So I see George Smith is asking, what if a firm had nothing but part-timers? And so let me just field that right now. So if it had enough, such that on average, the average worker, I'm sorry, if it had enough part-time workers such that the full-time equivalent would be 50 or more full-time workers, right? So if they had 150 part-time workers who each worked on average 10 hours a week, then that's the equivalent of 50 full-time workers working 30 hours a week. See how that works? Then that firm would be, it's got to be considered, because you got 50 or more full-time equivalent employees. But then they would go and look and say, okay, anybody you have working for this firm who works 30 or more hours, you have to have health insurance, but there would be zero such employees according to your hypothetical. So that employer wouldn't have to pay anything just because he hired nothing but part-time workers. Okay. So you might think, okay, well, now we know how that's done, we can move on. Well, no, because in reality, you wouldn't want to have to do it month by month. That would be ridiculously cumbersome, right? You wouldn't want each company every month to look at that month and say, okay, who's full-time, who wasn't, and then either have health insurance or not, or pay a fee or not, based on just one month's history. That would be crazy. And so they want to make it a broader thing. So, hang on, I meant one point let me just make. Some people are saying, hey, we wouldn't even see this in the data yet. Why are we looking at employment patterns to see if Obamacare had an impact? Because the employer mandate doesn't even kick in until 2014. So don't we have to wait at least, you know, several months into 2014 and look at hiring patterns? Well, no, because technically the mandate doesn't begin until 2014, but when the government wants to look at the composition of your workforce as an employer to determine who's eligible and you know what your tax is going to be, if any, they're going to have to use data from 2013 in order to make that determination. And so that's why businesses were actually dealing with complying with asking their tax attorneys, hey, you got to look into this a long time ago. You know, they knew in 2013 their hiring decision then were going to affect their tax liability, in April 2015. because in April 2015 is when they got to settle up for their 2014 tax year, but their tax liability in 2014 was itself going to be based in part, especially in the first half, on what their workforce was like in 2013. Does anyone see how that works? Okay, so in general, and again, I'm relying on that summary of the 144-page IRS guideline for employers that that law firm put out. My understanding is the employer has some flexibility in the look-back period, right? So again, you're not going to do it month by month. That would be insane. And so you can do more of an average thing and just have a certain period and say, over the course of this period, on average, what did our workforce characteristics look like to determine the liability to the employer vis-a-vis the Affordable Care Act? And so it's the look back period has to be at least 3 months long, but not longer than 12 months. Okay. And that's what the general rule is going to be going forward. However, in 2014, there's like a lot of little caveats to that general rule because that's the transition year, right? This all starts in 2014. And so they put in a lot of stuff, I think, because they don't want to have really screwing incentives and have people do, you know, hire a bunch of people and then drop them and blah, blah, blah. So in any event, that general rule, there were more restrictions on what the look back period could be as an employer for 2014, because that was going to be relying on a period before the ACA was technically in force. If you get what I'm, or you get what I'm saying, the employer mandate wouldn't have been done in 2013. So anyway, I didn't think it was worth getting into all the minutia about that. So I'm just letting you know there's a bunch more qualifications. But in general, like once we get into 2015 and we're moving forward, the employer, I believe, can just declare this is the look back period I'm using, and it can be anywhere from 3 to 12 months. And so they look at the workforce looking backward over such a duration, and those are the characteristics, and then that's how they do their tax liability. And then there's a what's called a stability period that has the same duration as the look back period. And it looks as if an employee is full time according to the look back period, then he or she will also be full time for the going forward for that same length of look back. All right. So another for example, if you have a 6 month look back period, and you have a particular employee who is full-time on average over that previous 6 months, then that employee is full-time going forward 6 months, and you're going to have health insurance for that employee, you know, if your firm has 50 or more full-time equivalent employees. All right, so there's different pros and cons there of making a longer or shorter look-back period, among other things. You know, the longer you make it, that might help you if there's spikes in employment. You know, you might want to say, oh, I'll make it a longer look back period to try to even it out and get more people to be below the threshold. But the longer you make it, then that means for the ones that do top the threshold, you're locked in for longer going forward. And so I think there's trade-offs that way. So part of the problem, I mean, let me just mention this before I move on. One thing that jumps out to me as an economist from that is just that little feature right there is just yet another reason that you would be very hesitant to hire a full-time employee. Because depending on the look-back period you want to declare, you know, if you then want to cut the person's hours because the business slows down or something, it looks like you're still on the hook. Again, my understanding of the rules, you're still on the hook for that person for the duration of that look back period. Okay, so it's not even that on the margin, oh, if you have a full-time worker, now you got to pay them the health insurance. It's that then if you changed your mind and wanted to bring them down to part-time, you're still stuck having to pay their health insurance for at least 3 months, up to 12 months, depending on, you know, what your accountants tell you the best look back period for your firm is. Okay, so it really, just the baggage now that a company hiring a full-time worker is just a lot more than it used to be. One last thing on this slide before I move on. So I did see, I didn't type it up here, it's sort of implicit in this, but I did see that legal firm officially say it is generally understood that any employee who's only hired for 3 months, for 90 days or less, or fewer, is not covered under this. Right? So even if you're working the person like crazy, because there's what's called a waiting period. Right, when you hire somebody, you in your employer, you're not obligated to be given health insurance on day one, right? You hire the person, he comes in the next day for work and he's sitting there at the coffee machine and meeting all the new coworkers. It's not like you have to have a health policy for that person put into force that day. There's a waiting period involved. And so they were saying it looks to be the case that if you hire somebody for 90 days or shorter, that you're not obligated to provide health insurance. So for those of you who are asking, what about seasonal employment, like with the holidays and stuff, that it's not just part-time workers, a lot of stores at the mall or whatever, I mean, they might take on workers who are working 60 hours a week, but it's only for November and December. And so do they now have to get health insurance for those people? My understanding is no, they don't. Now, if they kept them as employees, depending on their look back period, it's possible that working all those crazy hours in November and December, even if then they drop down to 20 hours in January, put in, let's say it was a 3 month look back period, it's possible, but by the end of January, looking back, you know, now they're full-time employees. This is just a good example of what I'm talking about. So see how that would work? Let's say that normally you would have somebody who works 20 hours a week, but then in November and December, the person gets 60 hours, or don't make it so high, works 50 hours a week because, you know, they work in retail or something. And they love that. They love getting all those extra hours. That's great. Well, depending on the look back period, well, let's say it's 3 months, at the end of January, then that would be, if that store, if that's kind of typical for its workforce, which it would be if it's in retail, then, oh shoot, at the end of January, looking backwards, because we got November and December in there, boom, now all of a sudden all these people are full-time employees. And so I have to give them health insurance or pay the fine to the government. And they're still full-time employees for 3 months forward. You see how that works? And so even though they've dropped back down to whatever I said, 20 hours a week, the liability to me, the tax liability of the employer is still, it had like the inertia built in. Okay. So now I actually haven't told you what are the penalties. We've already seen on the individual mandate, remember just as a review, they started out apparently innocuous in 2014. It was only $95 a person, or 1% of household income, which actually could be a lot depending on how much money you make. But then we saw it starts ramping up. And if you remember what I said was, look at that. If the government is saying in the year 2016, the minimum penalty you're going to pay as an individual is $695, then that should give you some indication of how expensive this universal affordable insurance is going to be, if they're thinking that's the kind of stick they're going to need to force people to sign up for it. That, in other words, there might be people who would rather pay $690 and not have health insurance. And they're like, oh, no, we don't want that, so we're going to make the fine $695 to really make it. You get what I'm saying? So same thing here. Let's look at what this employer mandate's like. Because remember, given the tax code, and I think I talked about this in the first week's lecture, given the way the tax code works, if you have people who were going to buy health insurance anyway, it actually does make sense for you to get it from your employer. I mean, the only reason you wouldn't is if you didn't think you were going to stay at that job for very long and you didn't want to be losing your coverage when you switched. But putting that element aside, and especially if you thought you were going to stay with an employer for a while, it makes a ton of sense to have your insurance provided as one of the perks in your compensation package. Okay, so you shouldn't be necessarily looking at this as, firms are just, oh no, I don't want to provide health insurance to my employees. This is awful that they're being dragged, kicking, and screaming. Given the tax code, it's understandable. It's a market in quotation marks is being driven by the tax code response that employers would provide health insurance because most people would want to buy at least catastrophic health insurance. People who are employed, especially in stable long-term positions at decent jobs, that's something they're going to buy anyway. And so rather than get taxed on money and depending on their tax bracket, possibly pay 35-40%, have the employer buy the insurance policies with pre-tax dollars, and so they're effectively getting that marginal bump up in their total compensation after tax, if that makes sense. Okay, so when you're walking through this stuff, just keep that in mind here. All right, so I guess what I'm trying to get at is don't look at this purely as the government is just out of the blue forcing employers to do something that they otherwise would not have done. Right? It's not like they're just making them spend thousands of dollars filling out forms for the Department of Homeland Security or for the Immigration Service that serves no economic function whatsoever and is a pure deadweight loss. That's actually not exactly what's going on here. Given the tax code, a lot of these companies would have already been doing this without the mandate. Okay. But having said all that, what exactly are the penalties? So, again, I'm just reiterating in this first bullet point, which employers are on the hook here? You got to have 50 or more full-time employees using the full-time equivalent method, so where part-time employees contribute to the total amount and fractionally. And so if you have 50 or more, boom, now you're in the spotlight. But among your actual employees, only the truly full-time individuals are the ones for whom this is relevant. Now, if of those ones, it's the employer's responsibility to provide a health insurance policy that meets the standards laid out in the ACA. And if the employer does not do that, then he or she owes more tax to the government, and it works out to be it's either $2,000 an employee per year or $3,000 an employee per year. Okay, now if you go and look at the actual wording, it's 1/12 of those numbers, and why that is, it's because it's done monthly. So remember, it's the same thing with the individual mandate. So in April 2015, when you go to file your taxes, they're going to look back in 2014 and see how many months did you have insurance coverage and how many didn't you. And then you're going to be hit with the 95 or the 1%, whichever's more, based fractionally on the number of months, right? And so it's the same thing with the employer. If the employer only provided health insurance for 6 months, well, then they're only going to pay $1,000 or $1,500, depending on which one's relevant. Okay, see how that works? So that's why the actual wording, it's 1/12, because it's a monthly fee, but annually it works out to this much. Now, the difference between, is it $2,000 or $3,000? I mean, I read the explanation, and it's super wonkish and convoluted, and I don't think it's worth getting into. Right? It has to do with whether some of the employees have insurance or not, and It's a weird thing where just the way I was reading it, it's like if you're an employer and you offer health insurance that is substandard that, you know, does not meet the requirements of the ACA, like, you know, maybe the deductible is too high, something like that, or that it doesn't cover the appropriate amount of procedures, then the penalty you pay for the non-covered worker is $3,000, whereas if you don't offer any insurance at all, the penalty is only $2,000. So it's this weird thing where on the margin you're paying more for offering a substandard plan than not offering any plan at all. And I guess conceivably that's because they really don't want people to be stuck in bad plans. There is like a total cap whereby if you're an employer offering mediocre plans that are substandard, you can't pay more out of pocket total or pay more as a fee to the government than if you didn't have any insurance at all. So they do have that degree of sensibility in there where you're not getting penalized for offering some coverage. But if you're wondering what's the difference between whether you're hit for $2,000 or $3,000, that was the way I was reading it, which sounds kind of insane, but that was the way I was reading it. You have to pay more per worker if you offer substandard health insurance than if you don't offer anything at all. Okay. So anyway, in case you're getting lost in the weeds, let's take a step back. What am I saying? I'm saying if you're an employer and you have 50 or more full-time employees, for each full-time employee you have, let's just say you didn't offer any insurance at all, every year, in addition to your normal, you know, corporate income tax, whatever other taxes you pay, in addition to everything else, on top of that now, because of the ACA, you would have to pay to the IRS $2,000 per full-time employee per year. Okay? So you may remember from the CBO estimates of how they thought all this extra revenue was coming in that they were actually going to, you know, be having more than $1.7 trillion in new revenue coming in over the next 10 years. This is one of the reasons why, because they're in their models and stuff, in their forecasts, they're anticipating that some employers are just going to say, you know what, I'm just going to pay the $2,000 per employee. That's the cheapest way to comply with this. And so they're anticipating, oh, we're going to get a lot of revenue that way. All right. So like I did with the individual mandate, just think about that for a minute, of how expensive this is going to end up being if they're anticipating that some firm, and remember, these are firms with 50 or more full-time employees, at least using the full-time equivalent method, may just decide, instead of giving them health insurance, I'd rather just pay $2,000 per head per year and not do it and have them go to the healthcare.gov or go to the state exchange. And I'll just pay the fine. Because again, you might be saying, well, duh, $2,000 of course is less than whatever the insurance premium times 12 is going to be. Or, well, not necessarily, but you know, unless you're talking about a healthy 25-year-old, surely $2,000 is going to be less to them than paying for the employee's health insurance. But that's not the way to think about it. Because if they're paying a fine to the government of $2,000 because they don't offer health insurance, that means the employee, in terms of evaluating that compensation package, is getting nothing in health insurance. So he's got to take his after-tax dollars and then go buy his own plan. You see what I'm saying? Whereas if the employer provides health insurance, yeah, that's going to be more out of pocket than just paying a flat $2,000 to the IRS, but that makes the position more attractive. And so they can either attract better qualified candidates or they can lower the salary because they're saying, hey, we're also giving you insurance that is up to the standards set by the ACA. You see how that works? So that's why I was emphasizing before that it's not, they're not forcing you just to comply. Making you give health insurance to your employees does help the firm in the sense that it makes the position more attractive, and so they can compensate in other dimensions. So that's kind of, again, though, you just think that through, that shows you just how unaffordable the insurance policies of the Affordable Care Act are going to be in the government's mind if they're going to be having to force if they're thinking there's going to be a lot of employers who would rather just say, I'd rather pay $2,000 a head and not have to give this perk to my employees, even knowing that then that would allow them to attract better talent or lower other elements of the compensation package. Okay, so now that we've walked through all those details, what does it all mean, Basil? That's my horrible Austin Powers. So, let me just be honest with you guys. When I first was reading that stuff, I was, in particular, the thing about the part-time employees are included. I was like, oh my gosh! I've been walking around telling everybody and writing up, you know, in my analysis that this is going to screw up the incentives on the margin for hiring workers. And so I was first alarmed when I saw that it looked like, well, no, it wouldn't. But no, it's still in there. It will still distort the hiring decisions, and everything I said before is still true, because that that distortion still kicks in for a mid-sized firm, right? For example, what I had said earlier was something like, imagine if you were a firm that had, you know, 47, 48 employees and you had been growing and you were considering about expanding and maybe you're going to hire 2 or 3 or 4 more workers. Well, now that would be stupid, because by doing so, you would push yourself above the threshold. And now all of a sudden, because you have 50 plus full-time workers, now all your full-time workers put you on the hook for, you know, $2,000 a year. And so that's still true, right? The having the part-time thing in there, it actually, if you think about it, it even dings you even harder. Because before, without that part-time equivalent thing or full-time equivalent thing, you might have thought, oh, if you have an employer who has 49 full-time employees and they want to expand, now they're just going to hire part-time workers so that they don't technically go above 50 plus. So that's not true, but what is true is they won't even want to hire the part-time workers. See what I'm saying? Because if they hire just 2 part-time workers that together count as 1 full-time, now they're 50 plus, and those original 49 full-time employees now are going to ding them $2,000 a head if they're not going to give them health insurance. Okay, so it slightly changes the nature of the marginal impact, but it still is definitely the case, arguably more so the case, that a firm that's getting near that magic 50 plus full-time equivalent level, and you weren't providing them health insurance. Yes, somebody in the questions is asking, right, if you're somebody that had a firm that size and you weren't already giving them health coverage that met the ACA standards, then you would not want to hire and put yourself above that line. But also, even beyond that, though, Dennis that asked that question, even if you did give them insurance that met the minimum plan standards, once you go over and become eligible, then all that stuff kicks in with, you know, the look back periods and all that, and then, you know, it greatly reduces your flexibility as an employer. So I still would maintain, even if technically you were in compliance with the law in terms of the policies you offer to your employees, and you were 48 or 49, you would really strongly think through your prospects for the future before going over that magic line, because once you're doing that, now everybody's out, and so there's a lot of other things that kick in. Okay. The thing about would we see in the data, or is it possible there'd be a reason for an employer to prefer limiting people to 29 or fewer hours? Yeah, that's still there, because again, even though the full-time equivalency kicks in for the 50 plus designation, still in terms of how many employees go into the tabulation for what your tax is, it's only the actual full-time. So there's still, you would still if you're a big firm that's already being considered, you would much rather have a part-time or full-time in that dimension. Okay. The other point, which I think I might have touched on already, is when we go to look at the data, you should have already seen the effect of this, even though the employer mandate doesn't kick in until 2014 because it's relying on 2013 data. So on that score, or on that issue, I don't know how well you guys can see this if you're just looking at it from the broadcast, but of course you can get the actual PowerPoint and see it. This was the best breakdown I had seen of this issue. What this blue line is showing, and the red line is just a moving average. The red line's not something else. They're both looking at the same statistic. What this is looking at, and I think this is the most relevant thing for this question, is the part-time employment as a percentage of total employment. All right, so what fraction of the employed are part-time employed? And that's what I think, because it's, if you're just looking at absolute numbers, it's tricky because they, of course, crashed during the recession, and so it's hard to net all that stuff out. So I think the real issue, though, is of the workforce, of the people who have jobs, what fraction of them have part-time jobs compared to what fraction have full-time jobs? And that's the thing you would really expect to see moving significantly if Obamacare on the margin is going to be changing the incentives and make you as an employer want to hire a part-time rather than a full-time worker. So it's true, depending on what statistic you look at, you could say, oh man, it had a huge impact that it's much worse now. But if you look at this broader chart, you can see where the real action came towards this pretty substantial shift in favor of part-time employment happened right when the recession hit. That right in mid-2008, you started to see it, and then near the end of 2008 is when it really started zooming up. Okay, and so then this particular analyst here has pasted in the official thing. So notice, let me just walk you through some of this stuff. In economics, everything is forward looking, right? So it's just like it would be naive to say we'd only see hiring decisions affected from 2014 on because it's relying on 2013 data. By the same token, once the legislation's passed in March of 2010, employers aren't just going to sit there and not change what they're doing and then on a dime rearrange everything in the middle of 2013 based on what their look-back period is going to be. You know what I'm saying? Just for example, let's say that you're a mid-range company, and once Obamacare, the legislation passes, and you talk to your tax attorneys and stuff, and they tell you this is what it's going to mean when this stuff fully kicks in a few years. You know, maybe you talk to your board and whatever, and you make the decision, okay, we're going to we're going to use a lot of part-time workers, and we're going to just hire a few senior managers that are overseeing a lot of part-time teenage workers, rather than having, you know, five adults, we're going to have one adult and 10 teenagers. And that's the way we're going to do it. And we're going to buy a bunch of more machinery to automate the stuff. So let's say it's a fast food restaurant. They might say, we're going to spend a lot of money automating as much stuff as possible. And then we're just going to have one manager on duty who's somebody in their 40s who really knows what's going on. And then have a bunch of teenagers who all work part-time. And that's the way we're going to run our shifts. And so to make that manager be able to get by and get through a busy lunch and dinner session with a bunch of kids working for him, we're going to have to, you know, put a bunch of money into the computers and, you know, get the drink machines that you just press the button and the fries are all going into the thing automatically and blah, blah, blah. Okay, you see how that works? So if you're going to do that, you're going to start making those changes as soon as you know it's coming. You're not going to wait until December 2012 before you totally revamp your workforce and then start buying a bunch of new equipment. You're gonna, you know, you're gonna like do it in test markets first, probably, and make sure your model works, and then start expanding it to your other franchises and that kind of stuff. All right. So the point is, really, you would see an effect once people thought what the new rules were going to be, and so that's why it is relevant that this person is labeling. Like when the Senate's voting it, when the House is voting on it, so forth, and then when it's actually signed. It's when business people planning on the future have some sense of this is what the rules are going to be. That's when they're going to start changing their plan. But again, even having said all that, it really does look like to blame it on Obamacare per se is probably difficult to do. It's hard to make that case. Now, if you want to blame it on Obama, you can certainly do that because you could clearly make the case that by this point, they knew that he was – who did he run against? Was that McCain? Am I getting mixed up? Yeah, that was McCain. You know, you could say by this point, people knew Obama was coming in, and that's when they were saying he was FDR and was going to do the new deal and all that stuff. And so – if you wanted to, you could blame it on Obama. Because this is not just what happens during a recession. Because look at back here, yeah, I mean, it went up a little bit. Well, you know, went up during the last recession, but nothing like it did in this one. Okay. So anyway, that's just something there that yes, it is certainly true that today there is a larger fraction of people in part-time work compared to the middle of the housing boom, but it's difficult to just say, oh yeah, that's clearly because of Obamacare. Now, having said all that, and I realize now I'm being a classic economist here, I'm telling you one thing and then saying on the other hand, back in the summer of 2013, there were guys like John Lott coming out and some other people who were saying, we can clearly see the negative effect of Obamacare unemployment. And there was, in particular, there was a statistic going around where somebody had done an analysis, and I think this came out like in July or August, and I believe it was based on numbers through June. It might be a little bit, maybe it was like an August analysis that was based on numbers through July. But I know for sure that what they claimed was that year to date, 2013, and the reason that 2013 would have been so significant is that's when the data for the employer mandate would have been relevant, right? So that's why they were saying 2013 is when we would really expect to see a big shift because of Obamacare. And they said year to date, the amount of part-time jobs, there had been 4.3 part-time jobs created for every full-time job created. And so they were saying you can clearly see the marginal effect of this. The problem, though, with that, and there were a bunch of people going nuts, progressives who liked Obamacare, were going nuts on these data and these claims. For one thing, there's different definitions of what part-time work is. So there's something like part-time for economic reasons and part-time for non-economic reasons. So part-time for economic reasons is stuff like you want to get full-time work, but the economy's awful, and that's all you can get. Whereas part-time for non-economic reasons is stuff like you're a stay-at-home mom or something and you're waiting tables at night when your husband's home from his 9-to-5 job to bring in extra money to the household. So yeah, you're part-time, but that's all you want to be. All right. So just like with the unemployment statistics, how that can be misleading, the same thing here. And so the critics were alleging that John Lott had grabbed the data set that made his case look the strongest when blah, blah, blah. Okay. The problem though, when that stuff came out, is people were, and I jumped into this data too. If you looked at year over year changes, it didn't look like a big deal. You get what I'm saying? That the proportions, if you whatever this was out, it was like looking at July. So if you looked at January through July 2013, the numbers were like what Lott was saying. But if you looked at August 2012 through July 2013, then there were far more full-time jobs added than part-time, and the ratio was basically what the existing percentage in the total employment picture was. So it didn't look like it was even going to move the percentage much. You get what I'm saying? And so when that happened, I personally at the time was trying to figure out, well, wait a minute, does that mean – and so some people were saying why Lott got screwed up is that if you think about it, it's in the summer months when maybe people would be adding a lot of part-time employees because kids are home from college for the summer. And so maybe there would normally be a surge in part-time employment that always hits in the summer anyway. And so if you just look at year to date and you happen to be doing that in the summer, that might be throwing everything off. Okay, so that sounds plausible, but the problem is I was trying to say, okay, well then I should be able to do that for every year. So if I do that in 2011 and 2012 or 2006, would I get the same thing? Would in 2006 year to date in July or August, would it look like there were 4.3 part-time jobs created? And I couldn't reproduce it for those years, if you get what I'm saying. So I wish I had a crisper answer for you guys, but it's like these numbers bounce around and it's so people are so passionate that the people who hate Obamacare can give you 9 different reasons empirically why. See, this is clearly having a huge impact, and people who don't mind Obamacare can give you 9 reasons to show you, no, what are you guys talking about? There's no obvious effect on employment. So anyway, that's why I'm being so wishy-washy on this, is it's hard to get a straight answer. But clearly, looking at this chart right here, you can see that, you know, again, this blue line is showing the fraction of the total employed who are part-time employed. That has been generally declining, and this last data, I mean, I suppose you could say, well, no, eventually the last data points are going to zoom right up. But I looked at, just yesterday I was looking at the November 2013 statistics for the BLS, and I was looking at year-over-year changes. And the statistics I was seeing, part-time employment went down year-over-year, right? So I was not seeing it jump out at me that, oh my gosh, there's all this part-time employment. Okay, that's what I mean here. So I couldn't find it using November 13 data, 2013 data. Okay, but again, having said all that, I mean, we're not making up the stuff. The people who are going up and down, there are lots of big box, big firms, as well as colleges that are clearly, I mean, people have seen memos and stuff. They are limiting their workforce to 29 or fewer hours. So why would they pick that number of 29 or fewer hours? That's clearly because of the employer mandate. Okay. Another issue that came up was people were asking, did the major players in the healthcare sector, how did they feel about Obamacare? So I'm just calling big medicine. Okay. So this has just come out recently. Krugman, our good friend Paul Krugman, and is it Iglesias? Shoot. No, it's not Iglesias. It's some other, maybe it's Mike Konzo. Anyway, it's some progressive that Krugman links to a lot. Within the last day or two, a story broke, and then that person was all over it, and then Krugman picked it up. So, but I hope you're all sitting down for this. Believe it or not, Krugman thinks that empirically we have yet more evidence about how great Obamacare is and that the people who oppose it are just burying their heads in the sand. So what's his latest smoking gun? Because the evidence in Krugman's world is always on his side. Is he saying, hey, look at this. Now that the bugs in healthcare.gov have been worked out, somewhat reasonably at least, health insurance companies are planning on an advertising blitz of $500 million just in 2014 to encourage people to go sign up for health insurance. And so Krugman concludes, see, the people who have real money on the line all think that Obamacare is going to work. And so this just shows that those Neanderthal Republicans are a bunch of idiots. That's his argument. So one thing is Krugman never explained, at least I don't remember him pointing out, what do you compare that $500 million number to? He's making it sound like before they advertised zero. Well, the figure in 2012, which I was able to dig up, was $216 million. Okay, so I don't know what it was in 2013, but the point is that, you know, that $500 million, to know how big is that, well, keep in mind in 2012 it was $216 million. Okay, the other thing is, what if I wanted to show that the insurance companies thought this was going to be a disaster and they were absolutely terrified that, oh my gosh, if we don't get enough healthy people to sign up, we're all bankrupt because we know sick people are going to sign up. So what are we going to do? Oh man, I know, let's throw a Hail Mary and dump a bunch of money into advertising and hope to the dear Lord that enough people sign up for us not to go bankrupt. Well, we would see the same thing. You get what I'm saying? It's so the fact that they're advertising to try to get people to buy their product in no way says whether they think Obamacare is a good thing or a bad thing. I mean, their actions are consistent either way. I mean, I guess you could say if they were so sure it was going to fail, they would just go out of business right now. And so the fact that they're not going out of business means they think there's a chance it can work. But to view this as a vote of confidence in the actuarial soundness of Obamacare is kind of odd to me, that everybody admits the more people who sign up, especially healthy people, the better chance it's going to have actuarially working and allowing the private health insurance company to stay in business. So the fact that they're trying to get people to sign up, how does that prove they think this is going to go well? Okay. This issue of transparency, this was a big deal. I want to say in like August of 2009. Okay, so just refresh your memory, especially if you're foreign and you're not up to speed on the U.S. political cycle. So Obama was elected in November of 2008, sworn in January of 2009. And remember, he comes in with the promise of being the next FDR. He's going to give us a carbon tax. He's going to give everybody health insurance. He's going to do this. He's going to do that. He's going to fix the economy with a giant stimulus package. All right. And so it was in August, in the summer of 2009 when a lot of people came out in force. And that's when the Tea Party really started kicking in, right? Because the bailouts had happened earlier. You know, the bank bailouts happened under Bush in the fall of 2008, and so people were getting mad about that. So then it was in the first part of 2009 there where more and more people were getting upset. All right, so you had people getting angry and turning out. And so it was, anyway, even progressives in, again, I think it was August 2009 when this stuff really got heated. There was this alleged deal with the pharmaceutical industry. And you can, if you want to go look at it, you can go Google like big pharma deal, White House, something like that. And you'll probably see a bunch of stuff from the Huffington Post in progressive outlets about people being upset at Obama because he ran on a platform of transparency. And that's why I put this word in here. Among his other saintly virtues, and why people thought he was just going to be a qualitatively different politician, is he led his supporters to believe that, say what else you will about his policies, it was all going to be done in an open and transparent manner. And it was all going to be on camera. I can't remember the exact quote, but there was something where he was talking about health reform or health care reform. That was the phrase they used, because who could be against reform? Who could be against health care? Who could be against health? Who could be against care? Who could be against reform? So who could be against health care reform? They if he was, I think he even said something like, it will all be recorded. You know, it'll be on C-SPAN or something like that. And so, no, of course it wasn't. It was all behind closed doors. And progressives in particular were outraged that this guy, Billy, I don't know how you say his name, Towson, was just somebody they loathed from the Bush years. And, you know, and so at this point, you know, he had been in and out of politics. He switched parties and stuff. So just a real chameleon operator kind of guy. And, you know, looking out for numero uno. And he was the chief lobbyist for the pharmaceutical industry. And he was meeting with the White House often during these negotiations. So anyway, they, this deal supposedly was struck in which the White House agreed that, well, hang on. So the pharmaceutical industry agreed, okay, we will either slow the rate of increase or actually cut prices on certain kinds of drugs such that over the next 10 years, total payments to the pharmaceutical industry will go down by $80 billion. But in exchange for that, the White House agreed, okay, in the ACA legislation itself, we're not going to have any provisions there allowing the reimportation of drugs, and we're not gonna bargain with you guys, right? So there's, remember, in the ACA, there's all kinds of projected savings, bending the cost curve and all that kind of stuff, where they're saying because more people now are going to be, because the federal government now is going to assume such a larger share of total healthcare spending, we're going to bargain more aggressively with healthcare providers in lower prices. And so as part of this deal, it was like Big Pharma was saying to the White House, on our own, we will get you $80 billion in savings if you agree you're not going to turn the dogs loose on us and start bargaining with, you know, we don't want to have congressional hearings and stuff where we're getting drawn in front of the camera and you're yelling at us for the rate of price inflation, and cancer drugs or something. All right, so that was the deal that they supposedly struck. And the reason I keep saying supposedly and allegedly is, of course, both sides were denying there was such a deal, but then a memo leaked that showed what each side was agreeing to. And then both sides said, no, what are you talking about? That's not a memo. That's not what we did. But just this issue of reimportation, what does that mean? The issue here is with patent laws and so forth. I think it's patent laws. So the thing with drugs is you spend millions of dollars, especially with all the hoops that the FDA puts in place. If you're a pharmaceutical company, you got to spend a bunch of money. Let's say you're working on some new drug that helps people with a heart condition. You might spend millions of dollars developing a thing, having to go through all the batteries of tests and whatever. It might take 10 years to get to the finish line with all the stuff the FDA needs to do. You know, you do your trial runs and all that kind of stuff. You have your different cohorts going through and testing it, get the feedback. Okay, great. And now you're allowed to sell it. So you want to be able to sell it for a high price to recoup all the huge investment you put in. And it's worth it because if the drug that works and maybe it saves people instead of having to go get some costly operation, maybe they just buy this drug and that relieves the symptoms. Okay, so instead of them getting a $50,000 surgery, instead they just spend $1,000 a year on this drug. But the thing is, once you know the formula, once you know how to synthesize the drug, you actually, the marginal cost of making it, you know, maybe it's only $5 per dose or something. And so a person could get a year's supply for $100 rather than spending $1,000. And so the issue is that information leaks out. And so people in other countries can be using these drugs and paying really low prices for them. And the pharmaceutical companies are saying, we do not want it to be legal for somebody in the United States to order over Amazon or something these drugs from a supplier in some other country, because then that the immediate effect is it cuts into our profits, because now why would they buy it from us for $1,000 if they can buy it from abroad for $100? But then also, if that happens, then we no longer have the incentive to develop this stuff. And so there won't be any more innovation. So that's what's going on. That's what this reimportation stuff is. So the White House allegedly agreed, yes, we will not, because that's, just so you know, I mean, that's one of the ways that a lot of people are saying, you want to make medical treatment cheaper, well then stop having the government use guys with guns at the border preventing cheap medicine from coming into the United States, because that's what they're doing. There are people around the world who are getting generic drugs at a fraction of the price that American citizens have to pay, because the government at the border is stopping that stuff from coming in. And so a lot of people are saying, what the heck are you doing? You say you want to make healthcare more affordable. Why don't you let these cheap drugs come in? And so the pharmaceutical industry is lobbying Washington saying, no, you're not letting those cheap drugs come in. Okay, so that's part of what was going on. And allegedly in this deal, the White House agreed, okay, yeah, we're not going to push the reimportation stuff in the ACA. And so then the pharmaceutical lobbyist said, okay, great. If you agree to that, then we're not going to, take out a bunch of ads saying how awful Obamacare is going to be. Okay, this issue of the death spiral, let me just add a little bit to this. So again, the issue is there's a sense in which young, healthy people are going to be subsidizing older people and sick people. And so if you don't get enough young people to sign up, the whole thing's going to collapse. There has just now been another analysis done by the Kaiser Foundation where they're challenging that. And they're saying that wouldn't be a big deal. And actually, it's something I hadn't considered. They're saying beyond just their empirical measurements, they're offering an intuitive argument saying, look, there's community rating for premiums, but they're allowed to discriminate based on age. So it doesn't really make sense to say the insurance companies are going to need a bunch of 27-year-olds to sign up in order to pay for the bills of the 85-year-olds, because they're still allowed to set premium based on age. And so you would think the normal forces of competition, if you were implicitly charging 27-year-olds more than you needed to in order to pay for the 85-year-old, well, then why wouldn't somebody come along and offer a cheaper price to the 25-year-olds that better reflected their actual marginal cost? And so you see the argument? So at first that flummoxed me, and I was like, oh, yeah, that is true. How come nobody thought of that? But the more I think about it, I don't think that quite works, because my understanding is you're not allowed to be a health insurance company and only offer policies to 25-year-olds. You see what I mean? If you were allowed to do that, then that would be a great argument. And then there would be no death spiral. That some company would enter the industry and offer 25-year-olds the actuarially fair price, knowing that 25-year-olds with cancer, you can't turn them away. So there's still that issue. But it wouldn't be that you'd be charging the 25-year-olds effectively as a group to pay for the 85-year-olds, because you could just book. But I don't think you're allowed to do that. I think if you're going to be in the insurance industry, you have to give a policy to anybody who shows up. And so if every company faces those constraints, I think they're going to just have to charge more on the front end to the young, healthy people just to make the thing work. So anyway, but that's interesting. Okay, let me hurry up here. I'm officially at the point where I'm supposed to turn over to Q&A, but let me spend a few minutes on the international stuff. Okay, the country with which I have the most familiarity in terms of comparing the U.S. is Canada. I do a lot of consulting work for various free market think tanks based in Canada, and so I've already worked with a lot of stuff, so that's why the stuff I gave you guys was all Canadian-based. And I'm just touching on one thing here. If you are really interested in the U.S.-Canada comparison, I gave you a whole bunch of stuff in the syllabus. You want to go look at it. let me just say something, though. The stuff I gave you was from the Fraser Institute, and you might be surprised when you go to read it and say, wait a minute, this isn't very free market. So, yeah, they're not as pure there as the Ludwig von Mises Institute, for sure. But let me just explain whether you think this is a good idea or not. I just want you to understand where they're coming from. Canadians in general, the Canadian public, has a very low opinion of the U.S. system. They think that it's despicable, like the nature of it. And so they get very worried when some free market reform place wants to change the way Canadian healthcare is delivered, because they think, oh, so you want us to go to a U.S. system where poor people just die in the streets. And so, in other words, I think a lot of Canadians would consider with pride the fact that they have universal coverage. And so the Fraser Institute, one of its strategies has been to say, okay, well, look, let's just compare Canada to other countries that also have universal coverage, and you can see how we're spending way more and getting outcomes that are not as good, blah, blah, blah. And some of the things and some of the reasons for that are that even if you have universal coverage, you could still allow a lot of market-based innovation. Okay? So, you know, allowing people to go to private clinics and things like that. I included one thing in there for you guys to see how in Canada they look with suspicion if the authorities seem to be allowing private clinics to flourish, so that people are just going and paying out of pocket and stuff like that. You know what I mean? So different companies that all might nominally have universal access or universal coverage, they nonetheless might have very different approaches in terms of how much is it that the government really is monopolizing healthcare versus, no, it's actually allowing a lot of free enterprise. It's just that if there's somebody who's too poor to buy it him or herself, then the government comes in and subsidizes that person so he can go into what is a fairly open market and buy the stuff himself. Okay? Just like in the United States, for example, in food, there's food stamps, right? So there's nobody who should literally starve to death if you know which forms to fill out and you know who to call. The federal government nominally will provide you with stuff to go get food, and yet we don't think that the food industry in the United States is totally run by the government. It's not like we think we have socialized food. Okay? So that's whereas in the Soviet Union, they did have socialized food. See what I'm saying? Or in North Korea, they do have socialized food. So that's the strategy that the Fraser Institute is taking. They're trying to get Canadians to see there's a lot of market-based reforms we could introduce to bring in competition and so on without giving up the fact that every Canadian can get health insurance. So that's just you have to know that political background to understand why they write their executive summaries and stuff the way they do. But anyway, some of these statistics are pretty shocking, where you can just see, like, the MRIs in particular, number of MRI units per million of population, and you can just see the huge disparities. I like this one too. The average age of hospital facilities in the U.S. it was 9 years, and in Canada it was 40. All right, so just things like that. I didn't have it in this presentation, but if you go look at wait time, that's really bad in terms of Canada. There's also stuff, I don't think I included it, maybe I did, but it's something like 43,000 Canadians in the last year that they had data went abroad in search of, you know, medical care, and partly why that number, what does that mean? Because you don't know, well, what do I compare that to? How many people in the United States went abroad? But this should give you some indication of there's a sense in which the U.S. is a safety valve. Okay, so there's a lot of, how can I put it? So it's true. You can interact with people from Europe or from Canada, and they come from countries that have universal coverage. Some of them are single payer, some are not, blah, 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 okay. And some are outright socialized medicine. And it's true. Like they might have full sets of teeth and whatever, and you say, oh, gee, it must not be big. But part of what's driving that is that if they really need to, they can come to the United States. And that's certainly true for Canada. That I just personally, anecdotally, know a bunch of people living in Canada, because I was considering moving there one time when I was up there visiting. And, you know, just, I don't mind the cold, and the people up there seem really laid back compared to Americans. And I was like, you know, what if I moved up here? And I was talking to some of them, and hands down, the one thing they told me was, well, if you have to get a major medical procedure, you're probably going to end up getting it done in the United States. But there's no way, you know, you like got your hip replaced or something, or if it's something that just that's causing you pain, but it's not life threatening, you might be waiting a long time to have that taken care of in Canada. It's easier just to do it in the U.S. All right. So again, you could say, oh, that's, I mean, certainly it's not a scientific sample, and I'm talking to people who are already free market mindset, but they're not going to invent the fact that they had a procedure done, you know what I mean? Like they were telling me personally what they had done. And I was talking to like expats, people who had grown up in the United States and then moved to Canada. Those are the people in particular I was talking to saying, you know, how'd you feel about the move? And one thing was the weather, that, you know, you gotta be okay with the cold. But the other big thing was, if you need something done, you could be in trouble. Okay, I tried to get you guys something. What I wanted to do was get something from like the World Bank or from, you know, the ECB or not the ECB, but the UN maybe, or just some sort of thing just to try to give you a, because of course I can go out and get something from the Heritage Foundation saying how awful stuff is. I can go get something from the Center for American Progress saying how great socialized medicine is. You get what I'm saying? So I was trying to find something that was pseudo official to get it for you, because they come in standardized format, because then they try to do the same. They try to do apples to apples with different countries at least. I didn't find anything great on that. So let me just end with this last slide. I'll turn to your questions. This where this came from, and that's partly why I included it, so you know that it's not from a biased source in my favor. This was from an Ezra Klein article that had the title, "The U.S. Has the Longest Waits Among the Developed World," or something like that, in the context of healthcare. And so I saw that title, and I was like, what is he talking about? Because, of course, that's not true. And, yeah, as you can see, it's not true. So this chart comes from him in the article that he's trying to – and so the way he does it is he was trying to say – that, you know, once you account for the fact that some people in the U.S. just can't get any covered care at all, well, their weight is infinite. And so, you know, so he would use a sort of rhetorical device that almost by definition, if you're comparing the U.S. with countries that have universal coverage, then the U.S. has a longer wait time, if you get what I'm saying. So anyway, when you actually look, this is the one where this was some survey, and, you know, not that this is really the ideal thing, you'd want something more objective than this, but in any event, this was a survey where they asked people in these various countries, how long did you wait for these various things? And you can just see the survey responses. And so you can see that the only country that arguably does better is Switzerland. But other than that, it's clearly, especially for specialists in particular, It looks, well, I guess, the thing with Germany is I'm suspicious as to why, you know, are they really saying nobody ever waits 4+ months for surgery in Germany? And I don't know, is that because it's so great, or is it because they go somewhere else, or what is, you get what I'm saying? So anyway, but you can see here that in particular, Canada is just awful. And the UK is also bad. All right, and so, and again, this is just people responding. So that this is one obvious sense in which you can say what's going to happen with Obamacare is, I think it's clearly the case that people are going to be waiting longer for both routine and then also in particular specialized care. And we already see that happening where the demand for certain medical procedures is going up, whereas the supply of doctors is going down, or the rate of increase of the supply of doctors is going to be lower because of this. All right, so if you want to be skeptical and suspicious and paranoid, you could say that that's part of the plan, right? They knew full well this was, people were going to be upset, and it was going to appear as if greedy insurance middlemen and privately run facilities that don't want to take Medicare patients and don't want to take people from the healthcare.gov and want to just take people who pay out of pocket in cash. You see what I'm saying? Like, I think we're moving towards a system where if you're willing just to write a check for $1,000 to the doctor, you know, you can get your procedure done right away. But if you want to go ahead and have them bill it to the federal government and then have them come in and negotiate, blah, 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 you know, that it's going to be a $3,000 bill, and a lot of people, and you might have to wait 2 months to even get the procedure done. You see, so if you're going to start getting that two-tiered medical system, and that's going to be blamed in the free market. People are going to say, oh yeah, capitalism gives healthcare to rich people, but not to the, you know, the average 9-to-5 blue collar worker who's got to take the government care. That's ridiculous. So that's what I see is coming. And you can imagine the reaction's not going to be senators getting on the floor and saying, oh my gosh, we made such a mistake back in 2010. Let's repeal this and restore capitalism, and then we'll see the market work its wonders. No, that's not what's going to happen. Okay, let me turn to your guys' questions. Fred says, is there an incentive for large companies to break up into smaller companies with fewer than 50 employees? For example, take functional departments within a company and make them an individual entity. Yeah, I think there would be an incentive to do that, but again, it would... And I'm glad somebody pointed it out when I was in the middle of the lecture there. Strictly speaking, it would be a company that isn't currently offering qualified health coverage. And so that's partly what's mitigating the impact of some of this, is I think that most large companies, because of the IRS quirks and the fact that they can give pre-tax health coverage anyway, before Obamacare kicked in, meant that most of them were probably providing it anyway to employees. And so on the margin, they might not be getting hit as much from this as, it fits the pattern where really whom this is killing is mid-sized business, right? So companies that had 40 or so things and that were going to grow, now there's a huge big roadblock in front of them. And so, and that's really the pattern you see, like with Sarbanes-Oxley and stuff like that, where the giant corporation, they're okay with this stuff because they've got the lobbying and whatever, and a lot of times the regulations are imposing things on the whole industry that they were already doing anyway. And so on the margin, the compliance cost to them is not a big deal, whereas the up-and-coming innovative companies that might threaten the big boys 10 years down the road now have a huge roadblock put in front of them. Okay. Ms. Schaefer says, that Fraser paper says the Canadian government restricts the supply of health professionals and holds the wages of health professionals below market prices. Does the Canadian government actually restrict the supply of doctors and medical devices and control wages? Or is this just the result of the messed up incentives caused by the government control of the delivery of medical services? I would probably want to have to go look at that passage again just to see what the context was. I mean, for one thing, of course they restrict the supply of doctors just like the U.S. does with licensing, right? So there's that sense. And then they also, there's restrictions in the sense of limiting how much they are going to pay, reimburse for certain procedures. So there's that effect too. But I think you know that, and I think you're asking me, wait a minute though, are you telling me if I want to go pay somebody X dollars to do a procedure, is that illegal? Is the Canadian government going to get in my face and get in between us and say, no, you can't do that? I think there are aspects of it like that, but I would need to, I mean, because again, that article I sent to you guys, the news piece was saying how, at least in one of the provinces, people were alarmed. Oh my gosh, it looks like if government officials are allowing private clinics to flourish. So I would need to go look at that. And I will include that in the email blast I send out when all is said and done here to catch the loose ends. Just so you guys know, that's partly why also, I mean, I had thought about just going through a bunch of different countries and looking for you'd have to know a lot of the nuances in each particular country, and I just thought that was unrealistic for me to get up to speed on 5 different countries, for example, and all their different healthcare systems and stuff. And so that's why I didn't focus too much on that aspect of it. And I'm just trying to point you to some sources where you can go if you want to get more information. Okay, Biv asked a great question. I'll answer this one and then. Okay, yeah, there's just 2 more quick questions, guys, and then we'll wrap it up. So Biv says, what percentage of the employer mandate insurance market will not meet the effective coverage standards? And if they don't meet the standards, how much might cost increase? Is there a rate shock for the employer universe coming? I don't have a number to throw at you off the top of my head. I do think that there is a shock coming, because I think the uncertainty right now is not so much, I think the issue is not so much how many firms right now are not up to snuff and, oh man, we gotta, I don't think that's the big thing, even though I can go try to find that for you. I think the bigger thing is just in general, if premiums all go up by 80% or 40% or whatever the number is going to be, then that's also going to affect the employers who are still on the hook for providing that coverage. Okay, so I think that's part of the issue. Okay, and then the last thing is Nathan asks, is there a number that will be released at some point that will show whether the death spiral fears are valid? Yeah, I think the real crucial thing is going to be by the end of the open enrollment period, which is, what is that, March. That's when open enrollment for 2014 ends. And so I think at that point, once people see the numbers for that, then they're going to know, oh man, is this going to work or not? Right? Because right now there was not a lot of sign up, but the defenders of the program were saying, well, yeah, that was just because of the healthcare.gov glitches and all the disinformation put out by the Tea Party and the Republicans to try to scare people. And once they go online and once they see with all the subsidies and stuff just how affordable this is going to be, we're going to see people signing up like crazy. And once the insurance companies do all their ad buys and spend $500 million, so that's the way they're spinning it. So the real test is going to be when this open enrollment period closes, how many people have actually signed up at that point? And then the insurance companies are all going to know, are we having enough money coming in to pay these expenses, or is this just not going to work? Okay, so I think that's the real, and I mean, obviously you would know leading up to that, how is it looking? But to answer your question in terms of specifically, I think that's the major milestone and when people would know, is this thing going to limp along at least for a few years, or is this really just not going to work right away and that they're going to have to change something immediately? So keep in mind, I mean, guys like Krugman are saying, oh, well, if this doesn't work, then, they'll just repeal it and the Republicans will then be able to laugh at Democrats the next 20 years. Well, no, they're not going to repeal it. if enough people weren't signing up, they would just raise the penalty to force them to sign. You get what I'm saying? I mean, it's not like they would ever just take away the health insurance from the people that got it. The whole point of this politically was to give a bunch of goodies to people, so now they're going to be dependent on the government and vote for the Democrats. So that's politically why they did it. So they're not going to just undo it. If it doesn't work, they're just going to, you know, if enough people aren't signing up, they're just going to force them to. Okay. Let me stop there. So thanks, everybody. I will, like I say, go through and try to catch any outstanding questions that I missed from you guys. I know I certainly got more pessimistic about the future of health insurance and healthcare in the United States after going through this course, and I hope you at least now have a better understanding of what Obamacare is and what may be in store for us. Okay, thanks, everybody.